Hi, everyone, and welcome back to the Dance Music Sex Romance Podcast. I'm your host, Zachary Hoskins, and I am here today talking to Erica Thompson, who was another presenter at the University of Salford Purple Rain Conference. But Erica is also someone whose research I've been familiar with since before the conference. So we're going to go about this a little bit differently than I've done with these post-conference interviews in the past. We're going to talk a little bit about Erica's background as a Prince fan and about how she got started with this project. And then eventually we're going to get around to talking about her presentation at Salford. So I hope you enjoy it. This may be the last of the conference-related conversations that I'll be doing. I think we're going to kind of change gears in the next couple of weeks once again. But if anyone out there is still interested in talking to me, I'm sure that we can find an excuse. So once again, enjoy, and here's Erica.
I grew up listening to Prince because my parents would play him. They wouldn't play him in depth, but they would definitely like play the hits. So I was aware of him growing up, but I was like more into Michael Jackson. I hate to like always make that comparison, but you know, I was just like this, you know, Prince, okay, he seems like really talented, but he's kind of weird and kind of scary too. So yeah, I don't know, whatever. But then when I was a junior in high school, Purple Rain happened to be on BET, actually. And I just sat down and I was like, okay, I'm going to watch this. And I watched it. And by the time, you know, it got to Computer Blue, where he's like playing his guitar on stage with the blindfold and everything, like I was hooked. I was like, okay, this guy is an incredible musician. He's incredibly charismatic. Like, I need to learn more about him. And the funny thing is, I mean, this is around 2002, so I watch the movie, I immediately buy the movie, I buy the soundtrack, but then I was like, okay, let me see what new music he has out. And so that happens to be Rainbow Children. So if you can imagine, like, going from Purple Rain to Rainbow Children as your first, like, kind of introduction to Prince. And I think... So that was the period where not only did I get into Prince, but then I also kind of found out about his religious beliefs. And I was just like really curious how he made this transition from Purple Rain to Rainbow Children.
That explains so much about where we're gonna get into it more. You know, you're working on a project that is also what you presented at the conference about Prince's sort of his the progression of his spiritual beliefs. And yeah, that alone, I can see how that would create that kind of curiosity.
Yeah, absolutely. And I don't think, you know, it certainly didn't hurt that I was raised a Christian. Now, you know, I always like tell people I'm not trying to convert the readers of my book or anything, but I think because I came from a Christian background, I easily entered Prince through that lane. You know, becoming aware of his religious beliefs. So I think that certainly helped me too at that point.
Yeah. I think I've said a couple of times in conversations with other people on this podcast, I want to hear from somebody with that perspective, because so much of the writing and the criticism of Prince is written from a very secular perspective. And so people tend to be, if they tend to either sort of gloss over the spiritual religious stuff, or they tend to be sort of baffled by it, like especially at the point where he becomes a Jehovah's Witness, but also even earlier. And so I think that there is an important sort of voice missing in this conversation, because spirituality and Christianity were so important to him, you know, even well before the conversion. And I think while you can certainly, experience his music and love his music and understand it without having a certain spiritual or religious perspective, I think to not take that into consideration at all, you're going to be missing something.
Yeah, I would absolutely agree. And I think, you know, beginning my study, when I went back to Purple Rain and even further, you know, that's when I found out he had always been talking about God, which is like the premise of my book is that he always communicated and expressed a belief in God. And then he kind of adopted a spiritual mission to make others aware of God's existence. But it's always been there. Now, a lot of times it's been like coupled with intense sexuality,
right?
But it's definitely always been there. And I think to your point of people being able to listen to Prince and not necessarily be religious themselves, I think it was definitely easier for them to do so in the 80s and the 90s.
Right, right.
Well, the first part of the 90s, but then after, you know, as he became more devout, I think that's when he probably lost a lot of fans, or a lot of fans stepped away. Because it was just, especially with Rainbow Children, it was just too prominent there.
So, you know, you mentioned you were raised a Christian. If you don't mind, like, what sort of denomination and all that were you growing up, or are you now?
Oh, sure. I was raised a Methodist. I would say with my grandmother, we went to Methodist church, but I'd been to, like, Baptist churches as well. So I'm not a Jehovah's Witness, you know, nothing against Jehovah's, but a lot of people think I am, but
right.
I'm not. And now I would say I'm more fluid right now. Mm-hmm. I don't think I feel comfortable like claiming a certain denomination, and
right.
I think I'm still just trying to figure it out myself as an adult. But yeah, Methodist, Baptist, I would say is what I'm mostly familiar with and what I was raised with.
Mm. I was sort of brought up a Lutheran. My dad's side of the family were members of the Lutheran church, but I can't say that I couldn't even really speak knowledgeably about the doctrine or anything. But that was just the church that I grew up in. But I was curious just because, you know, Prince had kind of a very specific upbringing. You know, he was raised a Seventh-day Adventist, which is, you know, kind of a unique denomination within Christianity. And then, of course, as we all know, he ended up a Jehovah's Witness. He may or may not have still been practicing at the time of his death. And there was a lot in between where he was kind of like you just said, you know, sort of seeking and a little more fluid in his spiritual beliefs. So I think, I mean, again, yeah, this is really, it's really interesting work to kind of actually try to nail down where he is at every specific moment, because there are definitely, I think there are major turning points that you can see, even just looking at his career, that you can link very directly with where he was at that time spiritually.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm glad you kind of brought up his upbringing, because I've been hearing different things. But yeah, for my research, I've talked to church members of the Seventh-day Adventist church that he attended with his grandmother. So I know he was raised with that religion, but then also Park Avenue United Methodist Church. I mean, not only did he get married there, but he would attend that church in junior high as well.
Like, that's right.
There for a lot of summer programs too. So he has both Seventh-day Adventist and Methodist roots. But like looking at like the doctrines of both of those religions, they're pretty similar. I mean, it's kind of like your standard Christianity, you know, the Father, the Son, the Holy Ghost, and all of that. So it's a pretty standard Christian beliefs there. But as you're talking about, like, trying to nail down the different phases of where he is, I can just give you a brief overview of this. I've separated it into, I think, 6 sections for my book. And 3 of them is what I presented at the conference. So I kind of look at, you know, from when he was born to 1984 as being kind of the first phase, an early doctrine of really having a religion or a spiritual system that's based on sexuality. Mm-hmm. So he believes that through sexual freedom, he can achieve foundation. And you see that on songs like Uptown and Sexuality on the Controversy album. Mm-hmm. Then the next phase kind of goes through 1984 to 1988, and I kind of identify that as a struggle because for anyone who's seen, like, his Purple Rain tour where he's having these conversations with God.
Yeah.
Yo, man, what's happening? Yes, I know it's Easter, but because it's Easter, we're just trying to have a little fun. I know I said I'd be good, but they dig it when I'm bad. All right, all right.
And he's like, you know, I want to be good, but they dig it when I'm bad. So you kind of, the sexuality and spirituality, there starts to be that tension between those two, where they used to be, I mean, they used to embrace each other. Mm. And, you know, talking to people who knew Prince, you know, some of them saw that struggle, some of them didn't. But you can also hear it in some of his music around that time. Like, if you think of the song Temptation on Around the World in a Day. Like, that's a perfect example of that. And so the next phase is, of course, after 1988 to 1990, I mean, you have Love Sexy and you have Graffiti Bridge, and I kind of, I've labeled that as an awakening. And you really hear, like, Prince specifically embrace Jesus Christ. I mean, on Anastasia, he says, "Save me, Jesus."
Save me, Jesus, I've been a fool. How could I forget that you are the blue? You are my God, I am your child. From now on, for you I shall be wild. I shall be quick, I shall be strong. I tell your story, no matter how long. No matter how long.
But then, as you get into the 90s, like the early 90s, I've kind of labeled that spiritual wilderness because he's starting to explore other religions beyond Christianity. And for anyone who's read Maite's book, she talks a little bit about that too.
Yeah.
Where he's looking at Eastern religions, he's looking at reincarnation and karma and all of that. But then, of course, the next phase is realization when he converts to the Jehovah's Witness faith. And he even said in an interview, it's a realization, it's not a conversion. So that's kind of why I'm using that terminology. And then the final section is kind of 10 years after his conversion. So I talked to Larry Graham, and Larry Graham said Prince was officially baptized in 2003.
Okay.
So if you look kind of 10 years after that, that's kind of where he starts to, like, slowly perform his older erotic music, like when he surfaced with Third Eye Girl and he's performing Bambi.
Right.
And so from, like, that point to his death, I think there are a lot of questions about where he was spiritually. So thank you for entertaining that. I just wanted to give you a brief overview of the different sections.
No, that's great. And I don't want, you know, I understand, of course, that you don't want to completely give away what you're writing about, but if I ask you something that you don't want to share, that's fine. But I think it's great to be able to kind of hear where you're at in this research, so far. And I think, so I'm curious, you mentioned that there are a lot of questions around 2013. Have you had the opportunity? Well, let's start actually. Who are some of the people that you've talked to? Because you've been interviewing people all through his life.
Yeah. And forgive me, I don't want to click around too much to mess up your audio.
Oh, but sure.
I'm just going to pull up kind of my list here. But yeah, so I've been talking to people for 7 years.
Wow.
Off and on, because some people like Jill Jones, I had to pursue her for like 2 years.
Oh, wow.
It's taken years to get some of these people. But so I talked to Jill Jones, which was a really, really interesting interview because, you know, when I, you know, not to digress too much, but when I first started this research, I had heard rumors that Prince was into the occult, and I just, I didn't believe it,
because right.
I started this research with a really rigid understanding, like, okay, you know, he's always been talking about God, and then when he converted, you know, it was a happy ending, like, I had the research in a box. But anyway, so Jill Jones was able to kind of open my eyes to some potential occult practices that were going on in the 80s. So I talked to her. I talked to Howard Bloom, which was a Prince's press agent for many years in the 80s. I mentioned I talked to Larry Graham.
Mm-hmm.
I talked to Roy Bennett, who was Prince's set and lighting designer for 14 years. So
yes.
Thinking back to those conversations with God on the Purple Rain tour.
Yeah.
Like,
and the controversy, the stained glass. Like, yeah,
yeah,
I'm sure that he had a lot of insight. That's really interesting.
Yeah. So I talked to him. He was able to provide that. Also, Craig Rice, another one of his business associates. And you know what? So some of these interviews have really surprised me. Like, I talked to people you might assume that they're not going to have much to say. Like,
right.
Devin DeVasquez,
right.
His girlfriend, she was a Playboy model, and she only dated him for like 6 months in 1985, but she experienced a lot of that spiritual side of Prince. I mean, it's like he would show different sides of himself to different people and different women, especially.
Right.
And she just happened to experience a lot of that. So that was a great interview. And I mean, it goes on and on. I've talked to about over 24 people. So those are just some examples.
Yeah.
Too.
About what was the sort of genesis of, you know, we talked about how when you started getting into Prince, when you kind of started getting interested in his religious background, what was it that made you then go, I'm going to write a book about this? Because those are two different things.
Absolutely. So it's kind of funny. I mean, it goes back even further, honestly, than 6 years. I mean, it goes back to my undergraduate days. As a college student, I took a biography writing class.
Okay.
And I had a subject. I had picked a subject that I knew personally, and that ended up falling through.
Mm-hmm.
So then I was like, what? I need a new subject. I don't know. So, I mean, at that time, I was like really, still really into Prince, really into his spirituality. So I said, okay, I'll just do it on Prince. So, you know, I think we had to write like a 40-page paper or something like that for that class. And then I think it was just that experience of that class that made me just, it kind of pushed me to think about expanding it and doing a book. But I would say I got really serious about it in grad school. Okay. So I went to Ohio University and got my master's in journalism, and we had to do a master's thesis. And I said, I'm gonna do it on Prince. And that was around 2010. And that's when I started to reach out for interviews.
Okay.
To do new interviews, because in that prior biography class, I was just looking at interviews that had already been done. Mm-hmm. But, you know, as a journalism student, you know, I had to conduct my new research. So that's when I started reaching out. So I would say that. And then once the thesis was completed, I've just kind of been running with it ever since.
And your sort of day job is you are a journalist, right? That's kind of that's what you're doing while you work on the book.
Yeah, so I live in Columbus, Ohio, and I work for a publication called Columbus Alive, and I'm assistant editor there. And it's like a weekly kind of community entertainment paper. So, mm-hmm. Yeah, 9 to 5, I'm a journalist, and then I have to find time to do this book.
Yeah, yeah. What was the – so when you first started as a grad student, who were some of the first people that you talked to?
Yeah, the very first person was Gail Chapman.
Okay.
So, yeah, she was in she was pre-Revolution,
right.
A band member.
Right.
And she was really interesting because she was a Christian herself.
Right.
She was a member of The Way, I think she called it. So I was, like, really interested, like, how was that, being a Christian? Because, and the funny thing, and I don't mind revealing this, because in all of the biographies, like, everyone says Gail left because of her religious beliefs and she couldn't take anymore. And she said, no, that's not the case at all. I just left because I wanted to do something else. And she didn't see a conflict between her beliefs and what she was doing in the band, which I thought was really interesting.
Yeah.
But I will say it's kind of funny, like, looking back, like, when we had kind of talked about the occult stuff, I do remember asking her a question, like, because she brought up the concept of spiritual lightness and spiritual darkness.
Mm.
And I remember asking her, I was like, well, which side do you think Prince was on back then? And she would not answer me.
Mm.
So I don't know what she was going to say, but kind of knowing some of the things I know now, it's very curious to me.
Yeah. So that is kind of, and we don't have to get into that much, but it's interesting to me as someone who's not really religious or not religious at all. The definition of a cult is interesting because I can see how, you know, from a specifically Christian perspective, a cult can mean like basically any kind of pagan or, you know, non-Christian religious practices. And there definitely was, like, out in the open, there was some of that. You know, his fascination with astrology, you mentioned in, you know, in the early 90s around Maite's time, there was a lot of sort of, you know, Middle Eastern or just Eastern in general kind of influences. And then there was also some, you know, around like Black Album, Camille kind of period, there was a little bit of like talking about witchcraft and songs like Shockadelica and that kind of thing. That never seemed serious to me. So do you get the sense that, was he reading Aleister Crowley? Like, what kind of occult interest do you think he had?
Well, again, not because I want to save some details for the book, but it's like, I mean, like he said, there's obvious imagery. Another thing we can look at is the eye.
The third eye.
The all-seeing eye is very important to some occultists, and we can see that on the 1999 album, and we can see that through that period. And then toward the end of Prince's life, where he's wearing the eye rings, mm-hmm. and then he's got the third eye glasses, mm. and all that kind of stuff. But what I've learned, and especially from Jill Jones, is there were certain experiences that she had with him that it's like, I can't prove that this is what he was into, but I can only tell you this is my experience. It was dark. It was scary. So kind of draw your conclusions. And I think that's how I'm approaching this book. It's like, okay, here's the evidence. Here are the interviews. However you want to enter this, if you're entering this as a Christian or not, you know, however you want to interpret this. But this is what was going on. So I think I can see a lot of Christians interpreting it in one way and then others interpreting it in another.
Well, I was surprised to find out, because this is really something that never even crossed my mind, but I was surprised to hear that even in the early 80s, people thought he was demonic, you know, like you mentioned the eye in 1999, mm-hmm. and you know, certain I've read threads of people talking about this on the internet, and it never quite makes sense to me, like what, like where do we draw the line on what is demonic and what's not, you know? But but it is, this has been a conversation about Prince for much longer than I was aware of until, you know, fairly recently. I think like Questlove or somebody said that his parents would let him have Prince albums because they thought he was, you know, in league with Satan or whatever.
Yeah. Well, I think it, like, again, it depends on where you're coming from. So I think if I, you know, if I were alive during the I was born in 85, but right. you know, if I were older and experiencing his music, and you know, my Christian parents might might not want me to be exposed to that too. It could just be as simple as his outfits or his alter egos, you know, right. or altering his voice, or especially on Darling Nikki.
Yeah.
With the reverse, you know what I mean?
Like, that's right.
People label that a cult. I'm glad you mentioned, like, I think when you said, like, being in league with the devil, that made me think of another part of the research, because I also went back and looked at other musicians who came before Prince, because mm-hmm. especially in, like, African-American popular music, there's always been this thread of secular music
yes.
as being evil, especially right. if you go back to blues. Mm. And how, like, a lot of religious leaders would say the blues music is the devil's music. And then mm. you have Robert Johnson and the whole crossroads thing there, too, that myth or, you know, if you want to call it a myth, that has kind of stayed with rock and roll since then.
Right.
And if you, and so I really compare to Prince, not only to those blues musicians, but then also Little Richard, mm-hmm. Al Green, and Marvin Gaye. Mm. Those were all men who kind of, again, had a struggle between the sacred and the profane. Like, you know, they would perform secular, but then they went on, like Little Richard went on to become a minister and to do gospel.
Right.
And Al Green did the same thing. And Marvin Gaye wanted to, because I read all their biographies, mm. but Marvin Gaye couldn't quite make that transition that he wanted to. Mm. And so, you know, Prince experienced the same thing. And then I also look at contemporary artists today, like D'Angelo.
Yeah.
He goes through the same thing. So it's kind of been this consistent theme throughout African-American popular music. And I think that's where the academic side of my book comes into that. I mean, some of the other academics you've talked to, that was kind of the additional research that I did just in addition to interviewing people about Prince.
Yeah, I think that it's an important connection to make, and I think it's also the places where Prince diverges from those people is also interesting, which makes me think about, you know, your first kind of phase of his spiritual journey. He is early on does not seem conflicted about the sacred and the profane at all, which makes him, which in the early days at least, really kind of set him apart from this whole tradition in African American music. But there is also there is a precedence for sort of sexuality and religion converging in that way. You know, there's crazy, you know, memoirs by medieval nuns where they're talking about, you know, experiencing almost like sexual ecstasy, you know, and there's of course like that. Probably the most popular, comparison that people make is the, you know, the Song of Solomon. So I don't know. What do you think about this early phase for Prince? Like, does it make sense to you in your kind of understanding of religion? This kind of sexuality as salvation. How have you reconciled that in your project?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it has to do with Prince's fascination for hippie culture. Mm-hmm. And like speaking with, again, his press agent, Howard Bloom, because, you know, Howard told me like he basically sat down with Prince for however many hours when he first started managing him to learn about his life and to kind of hone in on the things that were really important to him. And so, like, according to Howard, those days as a teenager where Prince was living with Andre Simone and they were in the basement playing in the band, you know, that's also where Prince allegedly had some sexual experiences. Right. Really got into that hippie mentality. And then, you know, throughout Prince's music, he refers to himself as a hippie, and he references that a lot. So I think that is what was going on mostly in that early phase. That was just an ideology that he gravitated toward. And because he was raised a Christian, you still had some of that in there.
Right.
But I think that he was mostly fascinated with that. And then as time went on, I don't know kind of what was the trigger for him to maybe come back to that childhood religion and start to feel a struggle, but he just somehow just started to feel that struggle and feel a lot of guilt. But I also want to say this about the whole sexuality and spirituality thing. So some people I talk to, they don't buy Prince's religious at all. Or I don't know, like they say, oh, you know, maybe he has like some standard religious beliefs, but he's not like really devout. And a couple people, I think it was Chris Moon, who he worked with in his early days, and then Chuck Zwicky, the engineer that he worked with, and they kind of believed Prince incorporated so much sexuality and spirituality in his music because those are the two areas that kind of really tap into the human subconscious or that humans can relate to. Mm. So, like, according to them, like, Prince knew that his audience, I mean, they're going to gravitate towards sexuality and they're going to gravitate towards spirituality. So that's where I can really get to them. So I think that's an interesting perspective as well. I mean, either Prince was really believing these things, or he just was a master marketer and knew how to how to get people. And again, the way I approach my book is I'm not telling you it's one way or the other. I'm just telling you draw your own conclusions.
Yeah, that is it. I have to imagine it was a little bit of everything. Like I don't know. It seems too calculated to me for him to just be like, all right, we'll have some sex and throw in some God and you know, like instant fame. But I'm sure he was very calculated and he was aware of everything that he was doing. And, you know, he was very deliberate with the image that he put forward and his art. So that an element of that, I think, definitely makes sense.
Whatever you heard about me is true. I change the rules and do what I want to do. I'm in love with God. He's the only way. You and I know we gotta die someday. Think I'm crazy, you're probably right. But I'm gonna have fun every motherfucking night. If you like to fight, you're a double drag fool. I'm going to another life. How about you?
And you kind of touched upon the next thing that I was going to ask, which is this sort of, you know, spiritual crisis. I mean, not at the level of Love Sexy, but it does seem that around 1984, there's a turning point there. And, you know, Howard Bloom has talked about that in interviews that I've read with him. And that it's also just right there in front of us. You know, you mentioned the Temptation thing, you know, the back masking on Darling Nikki, which I always I just think that is so amazing because obviously, I mean, you were a child of the 80s like I was, so I'm sure you know that there was that controversy around backmasking around that time, this fear that it was satanic messages. So, you know, Prince puts a backmask message on Purple Rain, and when you play it backwards, it's a straightforward religious, you know, it's basically, it's like a gospel song, basically.
Right.
It's, which is just brilliant, I think. But you know, he's making these more explicit, you know, the song God and the song Temptation, he's making these more explicit sort of appeals to salvation. And it does seem like something happened. And I do wonder, we may never know because he shared a lot of things with a lot of different people, but he never seemed to share everything with anyone. But it is interesting to note this shift that happens in 1984.
Well, I'd like to, if I could kind of jump in,
yeah.
You just made me think of something else I touched on. There might be a myriad reasons. Like, there were a lot of people around Prince who became born again. I mean, or who were religious when they worked with him. So, of course, Gail Chapman, but then Des Dickerson, right?
Yeah, his conversion was, what, 82, 83?
Even early on the Dirty Mind Tour.
Oh, okay.
On the Dirty Mind Tour is when he became born again. And, you know, he didn't say, like, you know, in his book, and he was at the conference too, and I kind of asked him about it, but he didn't leave for religious reasons, but he was certainly feeling that tension while he was with Prince. And he said he had discussions with Prince about God while he was going through this.
Right.
So, you know, Prince could have been influenced by some people around him. Also, during the Purple Rain tour, he had some criticism kind of outside, like in the, I can't think of it off the top of my head, but there were a couple churches who protested some of his concerts because I want to say he did a concert on Easter or close to Easter or something. So he was getting pressure that way. Mm. And I think there was even a preacher who did an interview, like a newspaper interview, like condemning Prince. So I don't know to the extent that Prince listened to this criticism or took it seriously, but I think it's something to consider. So you have people in his inner circle who are religious, you have kind of outside pressure. And then another factor is his relationship with his dad. So he was estranged. I mean, he'd been estranged from his dad off and on throughout his career. But prior to like the Purple Rain era, he wasn't speaking to his dad as much. I mean, his dad had a problem with his sexual lyrics. And so then his dad comes back into his life. And coincidentally, he's writing spiritual music. And a couple people I talked to, Jill Jones, Roy Bennett, Craig Rice, they believed that Prince wrote some of his spiritual music to please his dad. So I think Jill Jones specifically called out the cross, and she remembered like his dad being very, very pleased with that song. And again, different people have different perspectives. So some people I talked to, they're like, there's no way Prince's dad was religious. I never saw that from him. But other people are like, yeah, he was, and Prince wanted to please him. So I think these are maybe some of those reasons that Prince made that shift in the mid 80s. I mean, we can only speculate, but I think it's something to consider.
That's really interesting, and you know, one of the first songs that John Nelson was co-credited with writing was "The Ladder," so that definitely sort of checks out. And then I think also it makes me think about Howard Bloom, his comment that, you know, he took this kind of Freudian perspective that when Prince was talking to God on stage, he was, you know, he was talking to his dad, basically. So that's a really interesting idea that I hadn't thought about before. Personally, part of my theory is, you know, you mentioned these other artists who have kind of struggled with this in the past, And, you know, right away, like Little Richard, I think a lot of his conversion had to do with struggling with his sexuality. Al Green also struggling with his sexuality, though in Al Green's case, I think it was just that he like couldn't keep it in his pants, basically. and I think with Prince, it was sort of a similar thing. Like I think it's interesting that, you know, really like both of his crises in the 80s seem to come at times when his womanizing is becoming especially destructive, you know, right before Purple Rain, he had been sort of concurrently dating Jill Jones and Vanity and Susan Moonsey. And obviously the Vanity thing imploded, you know, Vanity's whole life imploded. And I have to imagine that there was some guilt there. And then, you know, the breakup with Susanna Melvoin comes not much before his whole Black Album thing. And I don't know how, you know, again, this is all totally conjecture. I don't know how connected these are. And I'm sure that there were other things feeding into it, but it is sort of interesting that he starts having this, you know, this guilt about sexuality at a time when his sort of sexual relationships were becoming destructive for the people around him.
Yeah, it's really interesting. As I'm doing this research, like for all of these transitions that Prince is going through, what has remained consistent is his womanizing.
Right, like, right.
I mean, you know, even when he's making things like The Cross or Love Sexy, I mean, he still has a million different women.
Right.
And he may have felt guilty about it, but he really, and just based on my research, he really wasn't doing anything to correct that.
Right.
So that's kind of a disconnect. Like, I think you can really see his transformations in his art more so than in his personal life, especially during the 80s. Mm-hmm. And it's because it's not like people I talk to, it's not like Prince was in church or like they saw him with his Bible all the time.
Right.
So he's not like a traditional Christian in his personal life. It's just, it's more prevalent in his art until like maybe you get into the 90s. But yeah, like you said, he may have felt guilt over it, but he really wasn't reconciling that in his personal life. But I guess he was taking some baby steps because, you know, he proposed to Susanna and, you know, Sheila E. said he proposed to her. And then, but the funny thing is Jill Jones also said he gave her a ring too. So I think it's a very interesting disconnect in between his personal life and his art.
So yeah, he makes this grand decision that love is more important than sex, like he says at the end of Temptation. And his solution is to propose to three separate women.
Yeah.
You know? But that seems like in step with what I think Prince did show a lot more kind of growth and self-reflection in his art than he ever did in his life. You know, this is something that I was talking to an earlier guest, Jane Jones, about, you know, something like the hallway speech in Computer Blue. Mm-hmm. Like that is such it's self-lacerating, you know, he's really cutting himself to the quick and saying like, look at what I'm doing to these women, and, you know, interrogating himself. And then, you know, he's kind of like, well, that's finished. And he, you know, puts it on the shelf and then he carries on. Like he has these moments of sort of clarity in his music, but it doesn't seem to affect his actual life all that much. That's why, you know, Love Sexy is such a strange album. I love it. It's a great album, but as a gospel album, it's bizarre because he's spending the whole record, you know, like kind of proclaiming how saved he is. But from what I understand, around the same time, he's kind of treating people in his inner circle like garbage. He's not really acting on these changes that he claims to be feeling. It feels like a slightly desperate album to me. Like he really wants us to believe that he has it figured out. He wants himself to believe that he has it figured out, but he really doesn't.
I know there is a heaven and a hell.
I mean, and then you go from Love Sexy, I mean, you know, kind of skipping over Batman, but if you go in, you go into Graffiti Bridge, and it's, I mean, again, he seems so passionate, especially in his art, but the extent to which it was occurring in his personal life, I mean, there's still a little bit of a disconnect there.
Right. So you said you talked about a few of these periods at the conference. What specifically at the University of Salford conference? What did you go into in your presentation there?
Yeah, so I just talked about those kind of first three periods up to 1988, and I stopped there. So, you know, fingers crossed, I applied to this new conference coming up in Minnesota. So if I were able to get into that, I would go into the rest.
Oh, but, great.
Yeah, so I just kind of talked about each of those eras, and then I kind of broke it down by album mostly. So again, when I'm talking about that sexually based spirituality, I'm talking about like Dirty Mind and Controversy. And Controversy is really interesting because he's introducing the Christian concepts, the Lord's Prayer, the Second Coming, and all of that. And 1999, and then when I get into the struggle era, I'm talking about Purple Rain, because to me, Purple Rain is kind of like a Christian album. I mean, not only do you have the message of the Lord coming soon at the end of Darling Nikki, but you have I Would Die For You, which could be coming from the perspective of Jesus, and Prince changed those lyrics in his concert, you know, to say he's your Messiah, and he would like point toward the sky. And then on Purple Rain, he would say, let the Lord guide you in like live. And then on Computer Blue, he talks about the righteous one, and you could interpret that as a lover, or you could interpret that as Christ. So I kind of went into that. And then, of course, I went into the Black Album and that the whole myth that everyone knows about that. And then Love Sexy. So I just talked about those three sections and kind of broke it down by album and wove in some of the interviews that I'd done.
Have you been able to talk to Ingrid Chavez?
Oh, I've been trying. That's another person I'm trying to get. Like I'm in touch with like her manager, but I'm still waiting for that one. But yeah, I desperately want to get that because, you know, allegedly she was his muse, you know, for shelving the Black Album, and she played a role in Graffiti Bridge. But what's interesting about that, I'm also trying to get Anna Garcia, who was Prince was dating kind of around that time, because some people say Anna Garcia was the real muse. And then you also have, like, I talked to Robin Power, who had that bit part in Graffiti Bridge. She was Morris Day's girlfriend. She was Prince's girlfriend for a long time, too. And she was behind the scenes, too. So it's like we have, like, one muse that Prince may put out front or that everybody knows about. But then there are, like, other women behind the scenes who are also really important to his music, too, that we don't always know about.
I'm just curious. I've always wanted to hear the other side of that whole, you know, we have this narrative. I can't remember exactly where it, the first place I remember reading about it was in, Alex Hahn's first book, Possessed, where he lays out this whole narrative around the Black Album, and it's, you know, Susan Rogers talking about showing up and everything is all dark and the, you know, lit by candles, and it's all very like gothic, you know? And Ingrid Chavez is there, and I'm always like, you know, something about, you know, I'm not saying that Susan Rogers is lying or anything like that, but something about that is it feels so much like a scene out of a movie that I want to hear, like, so what was going through Ingrid's head, like what was, you know, like I want to hear the other perspectives of that story, because it's such a bizarre you know scene that I think I don't think that it's been. I think there's more to be said about this than has been said, basically.
I agree. And I talked to Karen Krattinger, who was Prince's general manager at that time.
Right, and she was part of that whole.
Yeah, she confirmed a lot of those events in Alec Ton's book. So, like, I think the general gist of it happened, but I would agree that Ingrid is a voice that's missing. I would also agree that Kat Glover is a voice that's missing, too, because I think, just based on some things that I've heard, I think she played more of a role in that too than has been talked about. So I'm trying to to talk to her as well. But yeah, I think there are definitely some missing voices that could kind of clear that up.
If you had only been, I just a couple weeks ago, I talked to Karen Turman and Joni Todd, who were in the so-called esoteric French
panel. Yeah.
And Karen said that she was talking to Kat's manager, and Kat's manager put Kat on the phone with her. If you had been there, you could have maybe gotten that interview.
I know her manager too. I think she's still trying to work on her for me. Yeah, I know. And that's been, honestly, Zach, that's been kind of a challenge, because I just, convincing people that I'm doing something unique and that I'm not like writing a tabloid and I'm going to ask you about your sex life with Prince or whatever, you know what I mean? So it's about getting people comfortable enough. And I think where I've succeeded the most is people putting in a good word for me. Like after I interview one person, they go and say, okay, she's cool. Mm-hmm. I'll tell this other person to talk to you.
Yeah. That's, I have stayed away from, you know, doing any independent research for my own writing, you know, in part because it's already time consuming enough that I don't even want to like open up that can of worms yet. But if I ever revise what I've been writing, there are definitely people that I'd like to speak to. And it seems like that is going to be a challenge, because, you know, I think Prince was very tight-lipped, which I think leads people to want to kind of protect his privacy. And I think people are a little more inclined to talk than they used to be now that he's no longer with us. But there is still a sense of like, just kind of, I think there's just kind of a general suspicion around writers and journalists, you know, in the Prince community, that I'm sure is a challenge to overcome.
Yeah, I mean, and of course, so many people. I mean, when Prince was alive, and you know, I was making these requests, so many people had signed non-disclosure agreements. They were afraid. But the funny part about that is there are people who signed them that I talked to, and they're just like, I don't care, I signed it, but I'm still going to talk to you.
Right.
So yeah, I think that's a challenge. And honestly, I have a little bit of anxiety about some people I talked to before he passed, and they were so candid. And now that he's no longer with us, I'm kind of wondering, oh my gosh, are they going to regret that they told me this stuff? Not that it's like, you know, I'm trying to like throw Prince under the bus or anything, but I think it's important to my study. And I kind of wonder about that. Like, are they going to be mad?
Every time I watch other people's news, see a false picture of myself, another one of you. Try to tell us what we want, what to believe.
That right.
Didn't happen in a car, but somebody spoke to you. But I'm willing to do the work, do what I gotta do. I'm willing to do the work. Tell me, what about you?
So where would you say you are in the process of writing this book? It seems like you're pretty far along.
Yeah, I mean, I'm far, but I have so much more to go. So I have, and I had to recently calculate this for some book proposals, but I have 90,000 words, which is about 300 pages. But I still have more to do. So I would say I'm 60% done.
Okay.
And I could say, I mean, my hope is that I can finish this in 6 months.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it does. Yeah, I really want to get this done because I've been working on it for so long.
I imagine.
It depends on getting some interviews too. But
Yeah,
so I have a good chunk, a lot more to go, but I'm really determined to get it done soon.
Have you had any, I know you probably can't go into specifics, but have you had any interest from publishers or agents or anything like that?
So it's been really crazy, and just, I mean, just the insight into the publishing world and how cutthroat it is. So I had an agent for about a year after Prince passed away, and it's like, it was kind of icky a little bit because the day he passed away, everyone was like, proposing right. their books. And yeah. I knew a lot of these people hadn't even been writing about him. Like, yeah. we just wanted to get something out. So I worked with an agent, and we pursued a lot of commercial publishers. Yeah. And I was very fortunate because my agent really believed in my work, because he was like, oh my gosh, nobody's writing about spirituality. But a lot of publishers turned it down because they said, no one cares about this. Like, cares about this aspect of Prince. And my agent was like, I cannot, like, I'm dumbfounded. And so I think going to the conference kind of provided some validation for me, because I found like so many people who were interested in it. And so right. at this point, I'm pursuing academic publishers. I think I might find more of a home with them.
Yeah.
Like, than a commercial publisher. So that's where I am now.
Yeah. I was going to say that seems, you know, I've talked a little bit to Alex Hahn, you know, when he was in the process of his kind of, it's like a sort of revision, sort of update to Possessed, that he co-wrote with Laura Tebert. And I know that they were facing a lot of, you know, surprisingly, you would think that the market would be ripe for books about Prince, you know, relatively soon in the wake of his passing. But it does seem like there was such a glut of proposals that there's a sense that the market is kind of saturated, and, you know, which kind of sucks, because a lot of the books that have come out are not that great. You know, like, I think that there are, to me, there should be room for a good book about Prince, or you know, something about Prince that is like covering a different aspect of him, like yours, you know. But it does seem like the academic market might be more ripe for that. And with this interest in, you know, it really does seem like there's sort of a flowering in scholarship about Prince, like maybe at least there will be kind of a home for this kind of discussion, even if the rest of the world has moved on, you know? So let's talk a little bit. We're kind of doing this backwards from how I've done everybody else. But let's talk a little bit about the conference. You know, so you're from Columbus. Salford is a long way away. like, how did all of that go?
It was awesome. I mean, I had to do a GoFundMe because, you know, since I'm not in academia, you know, right. I didn't have a university to kind of pay my way. So
right.
I just did a GoFundMe, and, you know, thank goodness I was able to raise about $1,000, which paid for my airfare.
Oh, that's great.
So, you know, and I really owe it to like the community here in Columbus of like just people I've met through being a journalist. So that was cool. So I got, you know, but I still kind of like used all of my retirement savings to get to England, but I thought it was worth it. So I got myself there. It was an amazing experience. Like you said, there's so much scholarship around Prince, and there's like so many areas that I wouldn't even have thought to look into. Like we mentioned the esoteric fridge panel. I think that was the most interesting for me because I didn't know anything about dandyism. I didn't know anything about Marcel Duchamp. And so it was just amazing to kind of hear those different perspectives. And then also all of the panels around gender and sexuality studies. That was really eye-opening to me because I had never really looked at Prince in that way. So I think that was another one that was really interesting too.
So you said you're going to try to go to the Minneapolis conference.
Yeah, I applied. So, you know, fingers crossed that they accept my proposal and I can present. Yeah, I really would like to present those other three sections of my research there. Yeah.
If you don't mind, could you talk a little bit about those remaining three sections? Like, not to completely spoil it in case you do get to do it in Minneapolis, but.
Yeah, and that's kind of the area that I'm like actively writing right now. But yeah, it's just that, again, that spiritual wilderness, that first section in most of the 90s where he's searching again, and he's exploring all these different Eastern religions, and he has this fascination with Egypt. So exploring that, and then what's going on in his personal life too. I mean, eventually he settles down with Maite and kind of wants to embrace this traditional family life, you know, which is you could argue is kind of based in like Christian morality.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And then also, again, his conversion to the Jehovah's Witness faith. And what's interesting about that is, again, like going into this research, I just kind of thought it was like an instant transition. Like, okay, he converted, he's happy, he's content. Mm. But I don't know. I'm starting to question how content he was. I mean, right. during this period, he experienced a lot of tragedy.
Yeah.
So you could argue that that was just something he was able to grasp a hold of. Like, he was just, like, the Jehovah's Witness faith, like, meeting Larry Graham came at the right time where he was just in this dire state in life, and he kind of held on to that. But how long he could hold on to that, you know, is up for debate. And,
yeah,
you know, just drastically changing the way he wrote, the way he performs, like, not performing any of his earlier music. But then there's the extent to which he was living up to these ideals in his personal life is up for debate too. So I think, talking through that, and, so it was cool to talk to Larry Graham. I'll be integrating my interview with him into this, of course. Mm. And Larry Graham actually gave me the names of the books that Prince was studying at that
really?
Time. Yeah, so I don't have them off the top of my head, but I'm going to order them so I can kind of read. It's like a cool, it's so cool to be like, okay, Prince was reading these books.
Yeah.
And just, you know, so I'm going to look into that. And I really liked reading My Taste book because you have that contrast, like interviewing mm-hmm. Larry Graham and seeing it from his perspective, and then Maite, who was just not interested in this book.
Right, the total opposite, yeah.
Yeah, seeing her perspective too. And so then you go into the third section that I talked about, where you kind of start to question, you know, Prince's devout, you know, how devout he is to the Jehovah's Witness faith. And I want to mention someone I really want to interview too is Bria Valente.
Mm, yeah.
Because if you think about the women who came into Prince's life during this transition, so you have Maite and then you have Manuela. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I don't know for sure, but, you know, since Manuela and Prince split up, I don't think she's still a Jehovah's Witness.
Mm,
but Bria Valente, from what I heard, is still a Jehovah's Witness. And to my knowledge, she's like the only woman who Prince was with who is still a Jehovah's Witness.
Really?
So I think she would have a really interesting perspective on that too. So that's kind of what I'll be talking about, just his searching, you know, his realization, and then like later in life, you know, what does faith look like then? And it's interesting because Larry Graham said, you know, he believes that Prince was like 100% devout at the mm-hmm. time that he passed away. But I don't know to the extent that Larry Graham really knew.
Right.
You know, knew what was going on with Prince. So.
Right. And yeah, he certainly has an interest in Prince still being devout.
Yes.
At the time of his passing. That's got to be, it's got to be bizarre to actually talk to Larry Graham, because he's such a polarizing figure in the fan community, you know, and he seems like a really nice guy, like, just, you know, like he seems very personable and friendly, and probably like super willing to talk about the good news, you know.
Yeah.
but it's He's just looms so huge in like people's perceptions of who Prince was, and he takes a lot of the blame for you know, if we want to call it that, for the conversion and for all of the changes that happened after that. So that must have been a huge interview to get.
It was. It was amazing. But I will say he was very careful with his responses. Like,
right.
I could tell it was very, very like kind of tiptoeing around certain things. But yeah, I am just like incredibly grateful that he took time to talk to me. I don't want to be worshipped. I don't want to be no star. I just want to play funky music. I just want to play guitar. Bye.
So you want to talk to Bria Valente?
Yeah. Also Judith Hill, of course.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I get the sense Hannah and Josh Welton are quite religious, right? But not necessarily Jehovah's Witnesses.
Yeah, that's what I get that same sense too. So yeah, it would be great to talk to them as well. I haven't pursued them yet, but
right.
They would be on my list.
Yeah, I do. I think that that's especially exciting because, you know, so many people that I've talked to, and I'm also aware that because a lot of the people I've spoken to have, you know, were fans of Prince before he became, you know, sort of aggressively like evangelical. And so I think there's a lot of wishful thinking for him to, you know, have kind of crossed over a little bit back into the place that we were more comfortable with him, the sort of less rigid, you know, maybe still he was always religious, he was always spiritual, but maybe a little bit less strict, you know, in his adherences. And so I don't know how, you know, I think a lot of us kind of want to believe that he moved away from that toward the end, but I'm really interested in knowing either way, you know, where he was at, because there's definitely, I don't know, the spirituality that I see in his albums the last few years of his life feels certainly different from the Rainbow Children.
Oh,
and even
sure.
And even different from, you know, albums after that, where his religious convictions were kind of showing through.
Yeah, I would agree with that, definitely. And I think for me, like, I had to kind of let go of what I wanted to happen too. And
right.
I think for my research, it would have been so easy for the story to end at his conversion, but it's just, it's not that way. It's more fluid. And I kind of had to let go of that, of being rigid in that sense too. So I'm actually, I don't know if I have the answer yet. I'm still writing and researching, but I'm interested to see kind of, you know, what the final conclusion is. If there is one, I mean, you might just have to draw your own conclusion.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that is always, that's always the thing about Prince. He, you know, we're never going to know everything, which in some ways is sort of, I'm okay with that. You know, I think, especially when it comes to art, not knowing everything can be kind of a gift, because you're still able to sort of apply your own interpretations, and it kind of leaves the door open for other things.
Inside our minds, now to whisper in your ear, it's your game.
So I know you don't want to like put, you know, your research or put Prince in any particular box or convert anyone, but sort of as a Christian, what, you know, how do you think about, how do you think about Prince spiritually? You know, like, what has this confirmed your feelings, or has this kind of challenged your perceptions of him, or where are you at right now with understanding Prince in a spiritual lens?
Yeah, I think it's challenged me a lot. Like, at the beginning, I think it validated some things that I was raised with as a Christian. Like, it just seemed so hopeful and happy, because it was like, oh my gosh, after, you know, he was searching for all of these years and he finally found where he wanted to be, and the Jehovah's Witness faith, it might not be a faith that I subscribe to, but it's like, you can find where you can be, where you belong, and you can be content and everything. But as I went through the research, and I just saw that he just, you know, he was arguably searching even after his conversion and right before his death. So I think that has kind of certainly challenged me as a spiritual person, and like, you know, thinking that you can get like this very concrete happy ending and the stability. Mm-hmm. Because I guess even as we think about, you know, Prince's alleged struggle with drugs, you know, whether, right. I don't know whether you want to say alleged or not, just based on all the proof that we have.
Right.
It's almost like you would like to believe for someone who has such a strong faith that he should have been able to overcome whatever he was struggling with. But that's, you know, not necessarily the case. And it's not, I don't want to say that as to say that if he had been more devout, he could have beat it. Because
I understand.
Addiction is a disease, you know, but it's like, I don't know. It's just, I think, so I'll just say it's challenged a lot of my beliefs, I think, which is, right. which I think is good too.
Yeah, I think what you said about the drugs, I think that's something that it certainly seemed was going through Prince's head at times. You know, that feeling of like my faith should be getting me through this.
Right.
You know, you see it in Maite's book with his reaction to his son dying. He was trying to overcome his human frailties with God,
mm-hmm.
Which is, I think, certainly commendable. Unfortunately, you know, whatever we believe, like that, that's not always enough.
Yeah. You know? I think you articulated that, I think, much better. And that's where that sadness comes from too. And I think, you know, as a fan, starting as a fan, you kind of look at Prince as this superhuman figure, and it's like, oh, he should have, and then he embraced religion, and if anybody should have made it, it should have been him. So if he can't make it with spirituality, like, kind of where does that leave me, you know? I think maybe I've had those thoughts too during my research. So it's just been, it's been challenging and interesting.
Right.
Yeah.
It does... So much of his story, as he presented it, feels like a conversion narrative. You know, like I was lost, but now I've been found. You know that he did that with Love Sexy, and he did it again with the Rainbow Children. And I think, just as somebody who, you know, who A, doesn't really have a dog in that fight, and B, you know, I come from kind of a literary theory background. I find the complexity behind narratives more interesting than the narrative, and so you know, I'm compelled by the fact that Love Sexy wasn't the end of the story, and that there was more. You know, that he, like you said, he ends up going even deeper into the wilderness after Love Sexy. And that even the Rainbow Children is not the end of the story. Like, no matter how hard he tries to tell us, like, I've figured it out, you know, he hasn't. And I think that's a really compelling and really kind of human story, because I think even believers, and I've known a lot of believers, and I've been a believer, and I think believers will admit, most believers will admit that they don't know. They don't know everything. That's just part of being, that's what faith is, right? You know, like you accept that you don't know, and you choose whether to believe or not.
Mention one other thing that I thought about. Something else I'm exploring in this book is what role does commercialism and success and fame play in this story too? Because, you know, Prince, you know, can have his religious beliefs, but, You know, and there are different sides to it. Some people I talk to are like, no, Prince is not motivated by charts. He's not motivated by sales. He doesn't care. But then other people are like, no, he absolutely cared. Right. So if you think about going from Graffiti Bridge to Diamonds and Pearls,
right,
and how different that subject matter is, I think you have to ask the question, was Prince trying to like regain some sort of success with that? And does that conflict with his spirituality? So again, I don't have a concrete answer for that, mm-hmm. but that's something that I'm exploring for people to kind of draw their own conclusions to.
Yeah, well, I mean, that adds a whole other dimension, because unless you're going to make the jump and be a Christian musician, where there, you know, there's a lot of money in being like a specifically Christian, you know, signing to a Christian record label and all of that stuff, but that comes at the cost of no longer existing in the mainstream culture. So there is a whole other level of that conflict between, you know, the sacred and the secular.
Yeah, and I think what's so interesting too about Prince is the Rainbow Children period, where he was touring and he was like preaching so heavily
right.
During his concerts. But then it's like, by the time you get to musicology, he's still a Jehovah's Witness, but all that preaching, like, he's not doing that anymore. And I
right.
think that's, a lot of people go through that when they first convert to something. They're like super passionate and have to preach to you like every second. So like analyzing that has been really interesting too.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I certainly, again, I think this is important work. It's really interesting work. I really hope you find a publisher. I'm sure you will eventually. If you don't, I hope that you'll publish it yourself.
Yeah.
you know, I think it needs to be out there, and I'm you know, really eager. Whenever this finally comes out, I'm really eager to read it.
Thank you. If I could just mention, like, for listeners, please follow me at apurpledayindecember.com. That's my blog. I've been blogging there for 7 years about this process. So, and I publish little tidbits from my interviews there. So like I said, I just interviewed Robin Power and some other people. So those are kind of like the latest blogs that are up there. And if you know of any academic publishers or any publishers that might be interested, please let me know. If you know of any people that would be willing to talk to me, Bria Valente, Judith Hill, anyone, please do so. And I can't say enough great things about the other scholars at the Purple Rain Conference. I really feel like I've met family there, and I'm just like such a fan of everybody else's scholarship too. So,
well, great. And I guess one last thing I wanted to ask was, what is your, you know, we talked about these like six periods. Which is your favorite? Which do you identify with the most?
That's so,
save the hard question for the end.
I don't think I identify with one over the other. I guess the only thing I can say is maybe the wilderness in the early 90s is the most intriguing, because I think that's less cut and dry than the 80s, where you have sexually based spirituality and then a struggle and then like your awakening with Love Sexy. I think the 90s, it's just, it's murkier. I think that's most interesting to me. And I really appreciate everyone looking into the 90s, the 90s period of Prince, because I think that's kind of been glossed over. People don't pay attention to it. So I guess I'd have to say that the 90s.
Okay, great. Well, thank you again. It was great talking to you, and I'll keep up with your blog and see what's going on with the book.
Thank you, Zach, and I'll keep up with your podcast too.
Okay. Once again, I do want to thank Erica Thompson for talking to me. And thank you for listening. Like I said at the beginning, I think this is the last conference podcast for a while. But if you were there at Salford and you want to talk to me, feel free to reach out. I'm sure we can figure something out. In the meantime, you can check us out at any of the major podcast apps, iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and you can check out Dance Music Sex Romance at princesongs.org. Thanks again. Bye-bye.